This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're so glad to have you with us on this Monday. Last week, amid the intense media focus on Michael Cohen's testimony, there was another very important hearing on Capitol Hill. This one at the House Judiciary Committee focused on the origins of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy that led to family separation at the southern border. And with that, another alarming issue was raised. The 4,500 complaints of sexual assault the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or ORR, said they received between fiscal year 2015 and 2018. Here's Representative Ted Deutsch, a Democrat representing Florida's 22nd District.
I am deeply concerned with documents that have been turned over by HHS that record a high number of sexual assaults on unaccompanied children in the custody of the Office of Refugee and Resettlement. Together, these documents detail an environment of systemic sexual assaults by staff on unaccompanied children.
Many of those allegations involved one minor abusing another, but 178 of the complaints were against staff at the shelters, Deutsch said. Here's Deutsch questioning Jonathan White, commander of U.S. Public Health Service.
Representative, let me first correct an error. Those are not HHS staff in any of those allegations. That statement is false. Those
Commander
are
White,
No, sir.
Commander White, you are speaking of allegations of sexual abuse against members of my team. Commander White. You know what I've seen in these reports that were delivered to us buried in stacks of documents this thick without any notation? I saw thousands of cases of sexual abuse, if not by HHS staff, then by the people that HHS staff oversees.
And I have Congressman Ted Deutsch on the line with me now. Congressman, did you ever get a satisfactory answer to that question?
No, of course not. And thanks for having me on. What was so frustrating about the response was, here's the one person on our panel whom we knew opposed the separation policy. And I didn't expect that his defense of these horrific findings would be essentially, don't be so upset. This abuse wasn't actually done by HHS employees. It was shocking to me, it's troubling, and it raises a whole host of other questions that we're now pursuing.
HHS began keeping track of these allegations under the Obama administration in 2014. Wondering, A, what motivated that decision, if you have any insight on that? And the second question is, what's the protocol for investigating these claims? Whose responsibility is that?
Right. Well, that's a great question. Going back, the Obama administration actually went so far as to put a rule out to be clear about how these types of allegations would be handled. It was a serious concern with the large number of kids, unaccompanied minors, who were in these facilities. And we don't know about the process. We don't know how these kids communicate it. We don't know whether they're told how to explain to their caretakers if something is happening to them that makes them fearful or that puts them at risk, how they explain that. We don't know what the process is, and we don't know when they make these allegations. We don't know what's happened. That's the next question here. In these cases, some of it is really horrific, but it's showing officials, adults showing photos to these kids, sexual photos to the kids, touching the kids, really awful stuff. And we don't know that when they completed these investigations, all the report says is in some instances, the adult was reassigned. In some instances, they were terminated. We don't know what the Department of Justice did with all of them. That's what we need to find out. And we especially need to know why they were so defensive in saying that they weren't HHS employees. Well, if these were private contractors, what was the oversight of them? What was the background check process for them? And why shouldn't HHS be ultimately responsible for everything that they do. Obviously,
also Congressman, we did hear part of the testimony from Commander White of the U.S. Public Health Service say that the, quote, the vast majority of these allegations also proved to be unfounded when they are investigated. How we know that less than 200 allegations so far point to staff. The rest are seen to be minors abusing other minors. What do we know to be true right now?
That was the other part that was so disconcerting. HHS's defense was, you know, this is really less than 1% of all of the kids in our care. Well, it does amount to, on average, one case of sexual assault by an adult on an unaccompanied minor per week. That is unacceptable. And the tolerance level for this type of abuse should be zero. There shouldn't be any. That's why it's so important that we continue to probe to figure out exactly what's happening here in order to help protect these kids.
The point that you made at the hearing, Congressman, is that we know that there is this record of sexual abuse of migrant children without their parents, and yet still the administration moved forward with the policy of separating parents from their children. When you asked about this in the hearing, what was the response?
There was none. The only response that I received is the one that you played, which is an immediate attempt by HHS to shift the focus to the fact that this was happening. They acknowledged, but it wasn't us, is what they said. It wasn't our employees. And obviously that's a wholly unsatisfactory answer. The question that I then went on to ask, which I never got an answer to, was, did the Secretary of HHS know at the time that the president chose to move forward with this zero tolerance policy, did the secretary know that this type of abuse was happening? And did he tell anyone else in the administration? Did he tell the president? Did anyone, was there any communication about what might happen to these kids when they were taken from their parents and put into these facilities?
So last question for you. What do you expect Congress to do?
I expect the HHS officials to meet with us to give us answers to these questions. And if they don't, then it is likely the next time we'll see them is in another committee hearing where they'll be testifying before us under oath.
Congressman Ted Deutsch is a Democrat representing Florida's 22nd district. We reached out directly to the Office of Health and Human Services and have not yet heard back. Congressman, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sylvia Foster Frau covers immigration for the San Antonio Express News, and she followed up with one of the complaints outlined in the documents made public by Representative Deutsch. Sylvia, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You followed up with one specific sexual abuse complaint in a federal detention center in the San Antonio area. Can you give us a sense of what that complaint said?
We just kind of zeroed in on one of the allegations. It was a staff member that gave pages from a pornographic magazine to a child in January of 2016. It was at the Baptist Child and Family Services Shelter, and it was reported to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is the federal government agency, and also to the Department of Justice. So this one technically arose to some sort of level where they felt the Department of Justice needed to get involved. And then it does say here, you know, that this staff member was investigated and fired. Kind of an interesting aspect to this is that BCFS said in a statement that it has never had an employee charged with sexual abuse of a child in our care. And so that can kind of lead us to believe a number of things to explain that discrepancy. For one, we don't actually know if this staff member was criminally charged. The other distinction that I think is important to note is in these documents, when they talk about employees, there's federal employees and there's also staff members. And both, according to HHS, undergo background checks that include fingerprinting. But according to HHS as a whole, there were no federal employees that have been charged. So when you talk about the allegations against staff members, they were not federal employees. They were other staff members. And so one question that I'm still looking into is, well, why is it that the staff members that have been accused are not federal employees? You know, is there some kind of difference in the hiring process that would lead it to be kind of one group disproportionately accused over another? So that's another aspect that could play into that discrepancy.
I'm curious, what else can we expect? The reports that we continue to hear coming out of these facilities are that children have either gone missing, they've been sexually abused. Is there any hope for a strong response at this point to any of these allegations?
You know, I think the more we have hearings and the more we see data on just how concerning these allegations are, it is possible that more oversight will be put in place. And you have a lot of other nonprofits and other organizations and social workers who are constantly concerned about the well-being of migrant children. But in the end, you just kind of have to look at the national level, and you hear about words of a humanitarian crisis. But at the end, it really depends on what you think that humanitarian crisis is. You know, some want to place the blame on the human trafficking and the smuggling that comes across the border, and that is the humanitarian crisis, where others say it's the government itself for its housing of migrant children and inability to, stem the sexual abuse and sexual misconduct that happens. So it's really a matter on the national level of, you know, what is the humanitarian crisis? Where are we pointing blame? And then from there, you know, then the next step would be accountability for whatever they choose to focus on.
Sylvia, who is protecting these children? I guess the big question, regardless of who you are or what side of the political divide that you stand on, I feel as though at the end of the day, these are children. Is there anyone protecting these children?
So they're in government care, and with that comes medical facilities, and there are social workers there, and I think you have a lot of good people who come to those shelters and facilities genuinely wanting to care for and in some cases educate, and you know, whatever their role is, they're there to try to help these children and to ensure that they're placed in family sponsors that are safe and that will help them grow. So I think you do have a lot of good meaning people in these facilities that are genuinely there trying to help them. But, you know, this is taxpayer money. And so it really is holding all of us accountable for what happens to these children and if they make it out okay.
Sylvia Foster Frau is a reporter with the San Antonio Express News, and she followed up on one case of sexual abuse of a child in a federally administered immigration detention center. Sylvia, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's Tanzina back with you on The Takeaway. Ever hear the stereotype that LGBT people are better off financially than their straight counterparts? Well, it's been around for a long time, and it probably comes from the fact that the most visible queer people in the media have historically been well-off white men without children. Except research shows that queer people face higher rates of poverty and unemployment, and in most cases, they make less money than straight folks. Busting this myth is the focus of a new series called Queer Money Matters by the podcast Nancy from WNYC Studios. Nancy co-hosts Tobin Lowe and Kathy Tu join me in the studio to talk about the project.
I'm a huge personal finance nerd, and so when we started talking about doing a series about money and the economy, I was like, yes, give it to me, all of it. And then I feel like other people's eyes glazed over, but then, you know, we broadened out and we're talking more generally about the economy and how it's sort of built for straight, cisgendered folks and how us queer folks have to fit into it.
Tobin, when you started working on this, are you equally fascinated by personal finance like Kathy?
I would say I fall into the camp of cover my eyes and look through the cracks between my fingers at money.
Why is that?
I think like a lot of people, it feels scary to talk about, you know, like talking about money somehow, even though it's sort of like it's a hard number thing. It feels very personal and it feels like it's a reflection of how you live your life. And so I think that's partly why we wanted to do the series also, is there's this intersection of numbers telling you a story about how people live their lives and how the world influences them.
And it's so much shame,
yes,
right,
yeah,
associated with this.
Yeah, well, and this is, it's interesting. When we first had the idea for this project, we put it out, we have a Facebook group for people who listen on the show. And when we were sort of thinking, like, is this a thing? Is this a thing that we all live with? We just sort of loosely put out the idea of, like, do you feel like the economy is not built for you? And we got such a flood of people sort of sighing in relief of, like, yes, this is a thing I've thought about but never articulated.
I had to sigh a little bit because basically everything about being a transgender woman is expensive. Doctor shopping, therapist shopping, buying hormones, saving up for surgeries, and all that good stuff.
I'm hoping that I would love to, you know, be married to another woman, and then both of us are going to be affected by the gender pay gap. And honestly, I think that's why I'm grayer than most women my age.
I find, at least in my own experiences, that it's proven to be a lot more difficult to find work than before I was presenting as male. Mm-hmm. And then myself being a trans person of color adds even another layer to that.
Mm-hmm. So just seeing the flood of people being like, ah, yes, I'm not alone. To me, that was the worth of doing the project and talking about it.
The episode that comes out today is about having kids mm-hmm. while queer. I understand that this was one of the most requested topics. Toby,
yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? How did that come together?
Yeah, well, we hear all the time from listeners who are saying, you know, my partner and I are starting to explore the options. And as it turns out, you have to be very aware of the financial burden when you can't go the quote unquote traditional way of having kids, which is not to take away from straight opposite sex couples who also sometimes have to explore IVF or adoption. But I think we were interested in looking at how queer couples, a lot of them by default, have to start from the more expensive options. And how does that affect them?
When I did my research and looked into the different ways that queer couples make families, I landed on a technique called reciprocal IVF. Basically, an egg is taken from one partner and it's fertilized and it's then carried by the other partner. But I'm really worried about how expensive it's going to be. Just hope my future wife is rich.
And I think the thing that surprised me most was just couples talking to us about legal expenses that they weren't anticipating afterwards, especially if the child is only biologically one of yours. Mm-hmm. And then the partner has to figure out how do you legally protect your parental rights. Well, then lawyers have to get involved and you have to navigate the specific laws in your state.
When the vital records came down and asked who the father was, she says, there is no father. There are two women. My wife and I. So they refused to put my name on the birth certificate. And I told our family lawyer that, you know, I wanted to have a right and legal protections with my twins. And I was a sole breadwinner and I needed to ensure that my family was protected. So, you know, there was another $2,000-$3,000 that we hadn't accounted for.
So I think those kinds of fees that added up were things I hadn't even considered when queer couples explore having kids.
Then there are surrogacy fees, I'm sure,
yeah,
and IVF fees. And we should be clear that IVF doesn't always work.
Right.
Right. It's not a one-shot deal and it'll work. Yeah. Adoption often can take multiple tries, right?
Right.
So did you find that the couples that you were talking to were struggling with a lot of these other issues when it comes to having kids, just like the broader financial issues?
Yeah. Well, we talked to one couple, Alana and Claire, who they have it in their mind that they want to have children in the future, and they have this sort of like multi-year plan for saving.
I'm the person who's always thinking about finances, and we both just started out in our careers, and we don't really have the money to have a kid right now or within the next, like, the goal is within the next 3 years. And, like, in my mind, I've set aside, like, a financial plan to, like, hopefully be there in 3 years.
But to me, what stuck out in talking to them is that their multi-year plan assumes that IVF or some of the routes that they're going to take will work the first time.
Oh, no.
And so the way that they have to sort of accordion in and out what the saving plan looks like, depending on how much they have to try or how much they might have to explore another route, that seems very difficult to me in how you plan for your financial future.
One of the things that I find both terrifying and I guess becoming more and more real as the years go on is retirement.
Yes.
I think a lot of Americans probably are not prepared, should be better prepared.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kathy, you talked to one of our favorite coworkers, David Gable.
Yes.
He's our fantastic assistant here at WNYC. Tell us a little bit about his situation and retirement.
So David, lovely man, David is in his 60s, and he says this himself, he's not great with money. And when he was younger, he didn't think much about it. He worked in the arts and that sort of thing. And he also, as a gay man, he lived through the AIDS crisis in the 90s. And it's not that he thought that he spent wastefully. It's just that he never thought about what a longer life into retirement would be like. It wasn't a possibility for him.
Well, I remember my dad getting really mad at me and wanting me to, why don't you have more saved for retirement? And my mom gently intervened and went, well, I don't think David's thinking about old age. And it kind of went silent. So that is the moment when I thought, I do have to think about this.
And so now thinking back on all the years where he hadn't been putting away money, what is he supposed to be doing now to make sure that he has some sort of retirement?
I'm nervous that I don't end up in a cot with a bare light bulb swinging above me. But I will have a retirement, and I have a good job right here. Mm-hmm. And so it's possible, but boy, I'm still nervous.
That is sort of the situation that he is in. I feel like a lot of people are in. And there's like maybe 20 retirement homes in the U.S. that cater to queer seniors. And so what it comes down to is that it's sort of how it's always been. Queer people end up taking care of queer people, we help our own community and help build ourselves as we age.
Tobin and Kathy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tobin Lowe and Kathy Tu are the hosts of the podcast Nancy from WNYC Studios. And you can find a link to their Queer Money Matters series on our website, thetakeaway.org. The episode on family planning is out today. Is there an aspect of your identity that makes you feel like the economy is stacked against you?
My name is Mary. I live in suburban Philadelphia. I am disabled for life for 20 years. But I can walk, talk, and think very well. I would dearly love to work in some capacity. Alas, every attempt I have made for employment has been turned down. Experience in running an office is no longer considered an asset.
My name is Will. I'm calling from Philadelphia. I'm ADHD, and I often tell people that I wouldn't be taking my medication if our economy wasn't organized the way it is. To be able to work a traditional job and therefore to make money, I need to be on stimulants for at least a few hours a day. I don't consider myself disabled, but I'm sure a lot of disabled people echo this statement in many, many ways.
Hi, this is Cage, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. And I'm a queer transgender man, and I find that part of the reason that I struggle to be a part of this economy in the way that I really want to comes down to the LGBTQ community feeling just undervalued and not seen for so many years. And that in turn becomes something that you internalize as a person. I was socialized as a female and socialized to believe that I won't make as much, that I can't make as much. It's a similar thing for somebody like myself.
Yeah, well, this is Ricky Vassallo. The economy is not built for anyone. Our ability to survive depends on our percentage of positive reactions to our environment. And that's for everybody, regardless of what party we belong to. So let's stick together and let's stop having them divide and conquer us.
Thanks for sharing your stories with us. Tell us what you think on Twitter at The Takeaway.
The left is doing this because they know they can't beat us at the ballot box.
Legal pressures continue to mount against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Last week, Israel's attorney general announced plans to charge the prime minister with bribery, fraud, and a breach of trust. The charges are the culmination of a 2-year-long investigation into potential wrongdoing by Netanyahu. With national elections just 6 weeks away, Netanyahu has remained defiant about the looming indictment, calling the investigation, quote, a witch hunt. But recent polls suggest that support for the prime minister and his party could start start to erode following the Attorney General's announcement. Joining me now from Jerusalem is Ruth Eglash, a reporter covering Israel and the Palestinian territories for The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us, Ruth.
Hi there.
So this is an investigation that's been going on for 2 years. Why did Israel's Attorney General announce plans to indict Netanyahu now?
Well, I think that the process was set in motion about a year ago. The Israeli police wrapped up their investigations into two of the cases against Netanyahu. There's actually three cases, but two of them they wrapped up a year ago, and they made their recommendations to the Attorney General to indict the Prime Minister. They're basically waiting for the conclusion of the third case. And once he had that in hand, which was last December, he had to go through, or his team had to go through, all the information. And they decided that they didn't want to wait until after an election. The election just happened to come at that time, or some say Netanyahu brought it forward on purpose so that he could then be elected, even though he has these cases or these suspicions against him.
Ruth, you had talked about the three different cases. I'm wondering if you can just briefly explain what the charges were in these three different cases.
In Israel, they have names, and they're called very simple names. The first one is Case 1000, and that deals with the suspicion that Netanyahu accepted expensive gifts of cigars and alcohol, champagne, and jewelry from wealthy benefactors in exchange for certain favors. One of them, according to the police charges, is Arnon Milchan, who is an Israeli-born Hollywood producer. He worked on films like Pretty Woman. He is suspected of giving gifts of thousands or hundreds of thousands of shekels to the prime minister in exchange for getting the prime minister's help in business deals and also to receive or extend his U.S. visa. Then we have case 2000, which deals with deals or discussions that the prime minister had with a well-known publisher of one of Israel's main newspapers. And those discussions focused on whether the prime minister would bring legislation that would curb the circulation of another daily newspaper. That's case 2000. And case 4000 deals with arrangements that the prime minister made with another very wealthy or very powerful media mogul in Israel, who's called Shaul Elovich. And he is the majority, or was the majority, shareholder of the Israeli telecoms company, and also owned a very prominent news website. And the charges say that Netanyahu made deals with him eased regulations for him in his business dealings in exchange for favorable coverage on his news website.
Now, of course, Netanyahu will have a hearing to have the opportunity to challenge the charges before he's actually indicted. What's the timeline for that?
Well, there's no timeline as such. No time has been set. It could drag on for months. But I think they're saying that the Attorney General is going to come to some arrangement this week with Netanyahu's legal team about the timeline for that. But at the moment, it's not clear.
Ruth Eglash is a reporter covering Israel and the Palestinian territories for The Washington Post. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Well, you're welcome.
Over the weekend, the Sacramento District Attorney announced that the two police officers who shot and killed 22-year-old Stephon Clark, an unarmed black man, last year, would not face criminal charges. During the press conference, DA Anne-Marie Schubert also took the rare step of releasing details about Clark, including personal text messages and his internet search history. And that has generated intense criticism from Clark's family and community leaders.
The DA has shown us time and time again throughout her terms, who she is and what she stands for, which is not fairness or justice. She has never charged an officer for a homicide. My son is just the one that will break the mold because we're not going to accept that.
That's Saket Clark, Stephon Clark's mother, speaking after the district attorney's press conference. And Nick Miller has been following it all. He's the senior editor of news at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Nick, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the community response to the news. What has that response been so far?
It's been a mix of emotions right out the gate in the immediate aftermath of the DA's announcement on Saturday. Activists with the local Black Lives Matter and other social justice groups, they decided they wanted to do very targeted demonstrations, and they converged on a police station in the south side of town. Our reporters tell me that people were grieving. It was a very somber mood. There was some chanting. Some individuals wearing black masks burned the Blue Lives Matter police flags in the parking lot of the station. But it was a peaceful protest. Law enforcement says there were no arrests. People were not surprised by the DA's announcement. However, they found the way she went about it surprising.
Obviously, we're talking about Anne-Marie Schubert, who's the Sacramento District Attorney. What is her, I guess, style? What do we know about her before this case?
Well, this is her second term as district attorney. She's considered a more conservative prosecutor. She's reviewed 34 police shooting cases by county or city law enforcement officers since 2015. And she's not once prosecuted or filed criminal charges against an officer who's used deadly force while on duty. And she's been criticized for that. To her defense, before 2015, the district attorney's office did not even review these cases. They were done by the department themselves, either the sheriff's or the city police department. So she at least brought back these reviews. But, you know, she's been dinged. You know, people have said there's been some meaningful cases where, you know, deadly force was used by officers on duty, and they questioned whether criminal charges should have been brought.
So essentially, Schubert's decision here was not a surprise, but there were, I mean, given the sensitivities of this case, yet again, an unarmed black man shot and killed by police officers, this is something that this country is grappling with. So what was it about the way that she approached this particular announcement on Saturday that ruffled so many people?
So this is really interesting because local clergy, activists with social justice groups are accusing the DA of character assassination. And they're doing that because during this sort of extraordinary hour-long announcement by the DA on Saturday, she disclosed and publicized information that was unlocked on Stephon Clark's cell phone, which was found at the scene. And the information on the cell phone was private text messages between Clark and the mother of his children, where they're discussing an incident that occurred 2 days before Clark died on March 16th. There was a domestic violence incident, and Clark, according to the DA, was facing arrest. And he's discussing this incident with the mother of his children, whose name is Selena Mani. And he's threatening suicide. He's sending pictures to her of a handful of Xanax pills, saying that he's going to take them all if they don't try to get the family back together. And at the moment, watching this announcement by the DA, the implication of that, or the suggestion, was that, oh, is she suggesting that he may be committing suicide by cop, which means putting oneself, you know, in a situation where a law enforcement officer will kill you, you know, take your own life. And that suggestion, and then also the disclosure of these very private personal messages, and just, you know, what Stephon Clark was doing on his phone in his private life in those 48 hours leading up to his death, has really frustrated and angered the community.
And also, I wonder if there's a certain breach of privacy here. The person, Stephon Clark, is not with us to be able to speak for himself or to defend himself. So I'm wondering if that also raised some eyebrows.
I think that's a really good point. The DA, you know, she says she wasn't suggesting that he was going to be wanted to commit suicide by cop, but she said, you know, this is information that were these officers to be prosecuted and go to trial, the jury would hear this information. Therefore, it's important that the public know this information.
Mm-hmm. What's been the local response to this decision, the DA's decision? Are local and state politicians backing her, or do we expect a stronger legal response at this point?
So the response is really zeroing in on this idea of what is deadly force and what should the law allow an officer when it comes to when it comes to force to defend oneself, you know? And it really is sort of this tipping point moment here in California. We have the governor himself, Governor Gavin Newsom. He said this must be a time for change. He said, you know, clearly there's a problem because black and brown men and women are treated differently by law enforcement officers and therefore by the law than their white residents here in California. So there's this conversation that has been simmering for a couple years now at the state capitol, and it's now coming to a head. And we're going to see actual change occurring, or a conversation about change occurring on how our laws that govern use of force need to be updated or need to evolve.
Nick Miller is the senior editor of news at Capital Public Radio. Nick, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. And just a reminder, you can connect with the show on Facebook or Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. You can follow me. I'm at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.